Welcome, welcome, beloved listeners, to another week of LNL. Sad news about Christopher Kosh. He was a fine writer. And I recall that we did him 1 hour together back in 2007. And yes, we will put a link to that on our website. The years rattle past. I'm coming to the end of my 22nd year presenting Late Night Live, and about halfway along that track, I talked to a bloke called A. Scott Berg, who wrote a very fine Pulitzer Prize-winning biography of Lindbergh. It's not his only contribution to biography. He wrote a biography of Max Perkins, editor of Genius, which won the National Book Award. Golden, that's the fellow between Metro and Mayer, and also a book on Katharine Hepburn. But now, with impeccable timing, he's come out with a book on Woodrow Wilson, and I can't think of a more interesting president to spend some time with. Let's get straight into this now. It's just been published in the US, and the reaction has been, to say the least, positive. Warner Brothers have bought the film rights of the book, and Leonardo DiCaprio is slated to star as Wilson and produce the film. So why the Hollywood interest in Wilson? Wilson, in some ways, was an unlikely politician. He was an Ivy League academic. He was a history professor and eventually president of Princeton. Deeply religious, and photographs portray him looking very stern and aloof. But Scott's book tells a more passionate story than the photographs and newsreel films of the day. In a recent interview, Scott said this: "The subjects I pick are the lives that let me tell a bigger story. I use these lives as lenses to give a panoramic shot of 20th century America." And what a panorama. So, Scott, welcome back to our little wireless program after a 13-year break.
I can't believe it. It's nice to be back with you. I just wish we were face-to-face.
Well, unfortunately, the technology does not quite permit. Now, Woodrow,
not yet.
Woodrow was for us the president who took America into the World War I, very much the dominant figure at Versailles, which set up the League of Nations. And that's where you begin your biography in December 1918. The war has ended. Wilson's off to Paris to reconstruct the shattered world in the hope of getting a bit more democracy. Why did you begin at that point in Wilson's life?
I began at that point because Woodrow Wilson has now been dead almost a century. And even in this country, most people, certainly under 50, don't know much, if anything, about Woodrow Wilson. And I felt I had to plunge right in and allow the reader to do that as well and realize who Woodrow Wilson was in December of 1918 when he left the country for 6 months, which is quite startling. The President of the United States wasn't even here in America for half a year. But I wanted the reader, the world, to realize that in that moment, Woodrow Wilson was the greatest man on earth. He received the greatest march of triumph, and I'm not forgetting Caesar, Napoleon, Alexander, any of them, but it was the greatest march of triumph that had ever been presented to any living human being. And I wanted the reader to get a sense that this was, as he was called then, the savior of the world. And so I wrote this opening chapter, which is it's almost a kaleidoscope, so you could see all that was going on in the world and all that had gone on in Woodrow Wilson's life that led up to this moment. So you get kind of a good idea of who he was and whom you're about to spend some time with.
It's my great American literary hero is Dos Passos. And in a way, you do with Wilson what Dos Passos would have done.
Well, thank you. I really appreciate that, because Dos Passos was a great influence in my life in becoming a writer, actually. And for your listeners who don't understand what that means, John Dos Passos wrote a famous trilogy called USA, and it was done with a technique called pastiche. I mean, it was It was a technique in which he combined newspaper headlines, stream of consciousness, regular narrative, and you got this great just flurry of images and sounds on the page, and it was quite exciting, and I have always carried his techniques with me and have used a bit of that. I do it in rather straight prose, but I was trying to get that same effect of just spraying all the elements out there.
The panorama, and the depth. Exactly. Now, okay, he distinguished himself as a public thinker, but you note that he spent most of his life in private frustration, quote, half fulfilled, as he long harbored hidden aspirations he seldom voiced.
Well, that's exactly right. He was a closet politician all his life, at least until the last decade or so. But Woodrow Wilson really spent the bulk of his life in academia harboring this private dream of going into government service, going into politics. Wilson realized early on, even though he was harboring these dreams of, he wanted to be a senator from Virginia in his youth. He felt that was about as high as one could go. But even then he realized that in the late 19th century, early 20th century, it took a great deal of money and certainly some family background to get ahead in politics. This was a period of great corruption in American government, a period in which the wealth of the nation was really held in the hands of very, very few, and really almost every senator was in the pocket of some wealthy mogul in some industry or another. So Wilson realized he was just never going to be able to achieve his dream, and so he really tucked it away and went into academia. He had a beloved wife. He had three daughters, and he realized he had to make a living. And so he became a professor for most of his life.
Scott, who were his political inspirations among the presidents? Was he an admirer of Lincoln?
He was a great admirer of Lincoln, and this is somewhat ironic because Woodrow Wilson was our first Southern president since the Civil War. And this has great importance and influence later in his life. Not least of all because he did harbor racist tendencies and actually instituted some racial policy that was very much against the African Americans. And it's really the darkest mark against him, I must say. But his that being said, he so admired Abraham Lincoln. Wilson was not somebody who believed in slavery, I should add. But he also greatly admired George Washington, about whom he wrote an entire biography back in his academic days, and Thomas Jefferson, too, whose thinking was, in fact, different from Wilson's when Wilson was a young man, in that Jefferson suggested that the best government was that which governed least. And then Wilson became a progressive thinker, and that entailed having more influence of the federal government. And there's a great moment in the book where he has this moment, almost, you know, Paul on the road to Damascus, and he really sees the light and comes to believe that if Jefferson were alive in the 20th century, he would feel differently because America had become a very different country than the one he helped found.
Now, Scott, what you're pointing out, of course, is that he's very hard to politically categorize, to put in on the spectrum of left and right in 21st century terms.
I think you're exactly right. And I think even in 20th century and possibly 19th century terms, he would have been hard to categorize. He was a very difficult man to slot. And I felt actually the more I got into this book, the more I realized how important it was not to put labels on him or even politicians in general. My feeling the more I get into this is there is less and less black or white, that there are really shades of gray. Dare I say 50 of them.
And yet, he did things which would alienate him from the entire right wing of American politics. He slashed tariff rates that protected monopolies, passed the first federal income tax, created the Federal Reserve System to end the bank panics, or to hopefully end bank panics.
Well, that's exactly right. And in fact, Woodrow Wilson, now 100 years later, has become the great arch enemy. He's become the devil for the right wing over here. And we have a number of extreme right wing radio personalities, editorial writers and so
forth. Don't you say a word against Rush Limbaugh. Not on my part.
Oh, he's one of the moderate ones, Rush Limbaugh. We have a gentleman over here named Glenn Beck.
Yes, who, I know about Beck.
Yes, who
I'm making the sign of the cross.
Well, he declares Woodrow Wilson the most evil man who ever lived. This is on a list in which Adolf Hitler is number 6.
You're
but Woodrow
kidding.
Wilson is number 1.
Wow.
Yes.
Well, you don't share that view because you litter your text with biblical quotations. For example, the chapter called Ascension has this passage. So then after the Lord had spoken unto them, he was received up into heaven and sat on the right hand of God. That's Mark 16, verse 19. Why the biblical quotations?
I lead off each of my chapters with an epigraph from the Bible for a couple of reasons. But the central one is, I do believe Wilson was the most deeply, fervently religious man who has ever sat in the White House. He was the son of a Presbyterian minister, the grandson of a Presbyterian minister. And if you shake the Woodrow and Wilson family trees, a dozen or two more Presbyterian ministers will fall from the branches. So there was that. There was the fact that this is a man who, up until the White House and after, got on his knees twice a day to pray, who said grace before every meal, who read scripture every night before going to sleep, and religion so deeply infused everything he thought and said that I just felt it would be an interesting way to kick off each chapter.
This in contrast to the fake religiosity of so many presidents.
You have it exactly right. And so often, so many of our presidents who preach religion really don't practice it. And Wilson really was quite pure in this regard. So I felt it was really important to convey that sense. And also, each of those epigraphs was meant to be slightly ironic in that I felt Wilson himself probably thought of those particular passages of the Bible as he was enduring what transpires within that chapter.
As I'm not no fan of Glenn Beck's, but I am of John Maynard Keynes, and he says of him, the first sitting president, he enjoyed a prestige and moral influence throughout the world, unequaled in history. God, that's a big rap.
That is, definitely. And that's a lot to carry on slender shoulders. And he did. And that, too, goes back to the opening chapter, this big splashy opening I've got to the book, which was to show all of the world's hopes in 1918, 1919 were being heaped on Woodrow Wilson, such that everybody believed he could fix every problem in the world. And it was a huge responsibility, and he knew only disappointment could ensue.
We'll get on to the disappointments later, but it's a bit of a cliche, the child maketh the man, but in his case, where he was born, what he saw as a kid, his relationship with his dad are absolutely critical, aren't they, in understanding him?
Well, they really are, and you've hit upon something I've really tried to do with this book, which is to write the most personal and humanizing biography, not just of Wilson, but really of any American president. So often when you read biographies of great figures, the personal side of things is an afterthought. It's just sort of the tail on the dog. And I wanted to write a biography of one of these figures from within. I wanted to start with Wilson's DNA. I wanted you to get a sense of what it was like to be the descendant of Scottish Covenanters. I wanted you to get a sense of what it was like to have grown up in household after household, in which Martin Luther's thinking infused everything that happened. And so there it was. He was the son of this rather severe but loving father who was a minister. And Wilson's father believed strongly in education, believed strongly in politics, and all that was passed along to young Tommy, as he was known. And if you want to win a bet in a bar, ask what was Woodrow Wilson's first name, because it wasn't Woodrow, it was Thomas, in fact.
You know, I never knew that. It came as a shock to me, and I thought I knew a bit about Wilson. I like the fatherly advice you quote that Dad gave Tommy. When you frame a sentence, don't do it as if you were loading a shotgun, but as if you were loading a rifle. Don't fire in such a way and with such a load that while you hit the thing you aim at, you will hit a lot of things in the neighborhood beside. But shoot with a single bullet and hit that one thing alone.
Pretty fantastic advice. Father Wilson, Tommy's father, Joseph Wilson, was in fact a very erudite man, a wonderful writer, and just as important, a great orator. Now you can imagine with advice like that coming all the time, that's a lot to grow up with, that's a lot to carry. And in fact, Sigmund Freud wrote an entire book about Woodrow Wilson, trying to deal with this fact and suggesting that, in fact, young Tommy grew up with some hatred for his father for being such a superior, demanding figure.
I don't want to dwell on the racial stuff, but we've got to stick with it for a while. As a response to your book in the Washington Post early this month points out that he liked segregation, he supported it, encouraged it, championed it, an admirer of the Ku Klux Klan. Birth of a Nation was one of his favorite films. Wilson was an unapologetic white supremacist who set American rights in America, civil rights in America, back by decades. Do you cop that?
I don't, actually, and I think that's quite erroneous. He did not admire the Ku Klux Klan at all. He was not an unabashed white supremacist at all. He did, in fact, segregate Washington, D.C. This was, of course, 100 years ago. In Wilson's day, and this is the panorama, once again, that I try to show on the screen, Woodrow Wilson was very much a centrist in his day. This was a period in which there were Klansmen who proudly, not cryptically, sat on the Supreme Court, who sat in the United States Senate. Wilson actually was quite interested in moderating the racial attitudes in the country. Now, coming from the South, he really did believe in his heart of hearts that the country just wasn't ready to integrate at that time, at the turn of the century.
So he kicked the biggest can down the road. Did he make any gains at Princeton? Were there racial advances there?
No, there weren't racial advances, and it was the same thinking again. Princeton has traditionally had a very large Southern contingent, and there were a couple of episodes in which, say, a black theological student would come to Princeton to listen to a lecture or something like that, and there were more than one incident of white students, which was to say everybody at Princeton, of just standing up and leaving the room. Yeah. It was simply unacceptable in the late 19th century in Southern society for blacks and whites to sit at the same table. So Wilson, who then became president of Princeton, realized this simply wasn't going to happen, at least on his watch. And time and again, he said, even as president, he said, you know, it's going to take a generation, maybe two, before this country can really deal with integration. And if you look at the times when the United States really did come to grips with the matter, namely the mid to late 50s into the 60s, you'll see Wilson's calendar was right on schedule.
Yeah.
Now, that raises another question. Did Wilson, in fact, impede any progress? Did he hold things back by segregating at that time? And, well, I don't do tea leaf history, so it's hard for me to say. But that is definitely what Wilson did. He did segregate the post office and the Treasury Department, and that in turn sanctioned segregation to wherever any state wanted to do as much.
We're discussing a book with the simple, powerful title of Wilson. Its author is A. Scott Berg. And we're discussing one of the most contradictory and complex presidents in U.S. history. We've already mentioned his admiration of, his odd admiration for Lincoln, given his Southern credentials, and of the Founding Fathers. I hadn't realized that he had a long admiration with William Gladstone and the British parliamentary system.
No doubt about it. I think if Wilson really had his way, he wouldn't have been president of the United States. He would have been prime minister of the United States. As a teenager, when he really first began to read history and what became known as political science, Wilson was more than intrigued. He was fascinated and really somewhat enamored of the British parliamentary system. He thought, even though he loved the United States, even though he admired constitutions, he did think the American system was a little screwy, in which you could end up having a president of one party and a Congress of another, which just guaranteed there was going to be gridlock.
And isn't it interesting that he has a photograph of Gladstone over his desk, and when people asked about it, he said, "This is Gladstone, the greatest statesman that ever lived. I intend to be a statesman too."
Exactly right. And a statesman in the Gladstone tradition, certainly Gladstone's religiosity was not lost on Wilson. Wilson was also a great admirer of John Bright, great reformer, liberal thinker. So the great heroes in still Tommy Wilson's life, he really didn't become Woodrow until he went off to law school after Princeton graduation, but the great heroes in his life were the great British parliamentarians.
Unusually, in fact, uniquely for his era, he wrote his own speeches.
He did, and rather eloquently, I should add. Woodrow Wilson was the last president to write all his own speeches. He, again, because of his father's training of him, was a beautiful writer and a magnificent orator. And I hasten to add here that, yes, while he did write all his own speeches, most of the speeches he delivered, that is, those other than the really important documents, you know, declarations of war, things like that, Wilson delivered off the cuff. He would go to campaign stops. He would go to Congress periodically. And all these speeches, he'd walk in with a slip of paper with five bullet points, and he could then expound for an hour. And I've been through all these speeches, of course, and I've been through several of them many times. In all that time, because they would then be transcribed after he delivered them, I did not find one grammatical error, one sentence out of place.
And yet, Scott, you're talking about someone who, as a child, was apparently dyslexic.
Yes, dyslexic and slow to read. He really didn't learn to read until he was 9 or 10. But then he was just running out of the barn. I mean, he then became obsessive about it. He remained a slow reader, but he was a very thorough reader. And once he read something, he had something akin to a photographic memory, if there is such a thing. He retained.
Are you aware that Harold Wilson, the British Prime Minister, literally had a photographic memory? That's something that must come in with the Wilsons.
Well, I believe Ronald Reagan's middle name is Wilson, so he was a Wilson.
I don't think it applied to Reagan. You also reveal that he was a sickly child and that his health was problematic for the rest of his life, physical and mental.
Well, that's exactly right. He was plagued with poor physical health for most of his life, and as is inevitable, that did affect his mental health. This, of course, comes into great play because, well, I had the good fortune, you see, of writing about Woodrow Wilson 100 years later and having access to medical records. So I could go back and trace incidents of minor strokes that he was having as early as his 30s and 40s. Well, this becomes extremely intriguing when you have Woodrow Wilson over in Paris negotiating the peace treaty and basically drawing the map of the 20th century, 21st century even, world. And, well, there was a lot of aberrant mental behavior going on.
This leads me back to Sigmund Freud and this extraordinary revelation, at least to me, that Sigmund was the co-author of a book on Wilson, a psychological study by Freud and William C. Bullitt, which a lot of scholars dismiss as pop psychology and rubbish. How do you regard it?
Well, it's a nasty little book. It's a strange book. When it was published in 1965, in fact, and I will explain that in a moment, most people thought it said more about Sigmund Freud, which wasn't too good, than it did about Woodrow Wilson. What happened was there was, at the time, William Bullitt, who later became an ambassador, but back in 1919, he was a junior-level statesman who became very upset with Woodrow Wilson, did not like the way Woodrow Wilson concluded the negotiations. And so he quit, really a disgruntled employee. Instead of pulling out a rifle, his version was he had a friend who was Sigmund Freud. So he went to Freud, who was no great fan of Woodrow Wilson, as indeed an Austrian wouldn't necessarily be, who had lived through World War I. In any case, Bullitt went to Freud and said, listen, if I give you the facts of Woodrow Wilson's life, could you sort of put him on the couch and head shrink him? And basically, that's what the two of them did together. They wrote this book, and it really was a very contemptuous book. I mean, they don't even make efforts to hide their contempt for Wilson. The one thing they did that was rather gentlemanly is they said, we are not going to publish it until Mrs. Wilson dies. Little did they know, Mrs. Wilson would survive them by decades. She did not die until the 1960s. So this book was not published until the mid-60s.
My guest is A. Scott Berg, and we're discussing Woodrow Wilson. Let me quote something he said to his first wife. I have the uncomfortable feeling that I am carrying a volcano about with me. My salvation is in being loved. There surely never lived a man with whom love was a more critical matter than it is with me. Now, he's not simply talking about carnal love. He's obviously talking about public approval. But one of your discoveries in doing the biography was a suitcase full of love letters. Tell me about that suitcase.
Well, it's quite extraordinary. Again, you pointed out the rather grim-looking picture of Woodrow Wilson that those of us who have a picture in our minds have. What I tried to dispel in this book is that image. I wanted to point out this was a very red-blooded, even hot-blooded, and I don't just mean carnal, but I mean in every way, although he was quite sexual. But this was a man for whom passions were everything. His emotions ran very deep, and I wanted to convey that. That's part of writing this personal, humanizing biography of him. Now, it's quite stunning to me that here I am writing about him, again, a century after he died, and yet there should still be trunkloads of papers that surface. And in the course of my research in the last 13 years, two major caches of papers did arise, one of which was found when the last of Woodrow Wilson's grandsons died, and his family was going through the attic, and they found a trunkload of papers that had belonged to, well, the last grandson's mother, that is, one of Woodrow Wilson's daughters. And in going through them, there were thousands and thousands of letters, not all directly pertaining to Woodrow Wilson, but there were many to and from Woodrow Wilson. There were many letters from Wilson's daughter to her husband talking about Woodrow Wilson. But in the entirety, the Woodrow Wilson papers include thousands, and I mean this literally, thousands of passionate love letters between Woodrow Wilson and his first wife, whom he adored. They were in the White House 1 year, and then she dies. And this is really one of the most moving stories in White House history.
The DiCaprio movie will have to be R-rated. Let me just read a scrap of one of the letters. When you get back to me, you'll smother me. Will you, my sweet little lover? And what will I be doing all the while? Simply submitting to be smothered. Are you prepared for the storm of lovemaking with which you will be assailed?
Philip, I'm perspiring just hearing your reading of that.
Well, it is a pretty good piece of prose, isn't it?
Not
vastly, vastly superior to the rather crappy emails that are sometimes leaked by contemporary politicians. Who were the other key women in his life?
Well, there was this first wife, Ellen. They were in the White House a year when she died of Bright's disease, a kidney ailment. And then the most significant woman becomes an attractive young widow who was living in Washington, whom he met, and within a year had courted her, wooed her with now hundreds of these passionate love letters, and then married her. She becomes not just the most important person in Woodrow Wilson's life, she becomes the most important person in the nation's life, because Woodrow Wilson, when he suffered his stroke in trying to sell the League of Nations to the United States, Mrs. Wilson basically took over the White House.
And to a large extent, kept his illness a secret.
Yes, almost entirely. It is, as I suggest in the book, the greatest conspiracy ever to overtake the American White House. And that is, for a year and a half, Mrs. Wilson and a couple of doctors really decided that nobody should know how sick the president was, and that Mrs. Wilson should be making the day-to-day decisions. In essence, she should be the one running the White House. And indeed, in all that time, not a single person got to see the President of the United States, or not a single document appeared before the President of the United States without passing first through the hands and before the eyes of Mrs. Wilson.
You know, it's hard to imagine a world where presidential secrets of any consequence could be kept. And yet, down the track, of course, Franklin Roosevelt, the secret, the open secret of his polio, of the wheelchair. It was respected by the media.
It's quite remarkable. Certainly it couldn't happen today, and certainly in an age of cell phones, nobody can go 3 seconds without anything being kept a secret. And so, this being 100 years ago, this could happen. And the Wilson situation, in fact, once it was realized, became so terrifying that there is now an amendment to the Constitution of the United States, the 25th Amendment, which quite in great detail describes what presidential disability is and at what point does the president get removed from office, even if he doesn't wish to be removed.
This leads us on to the third key woman, who had an apparently platonic friendship with Wilson. Tell us about Mary Peck.
Yes, the notorious Mrs. Peck, as the opposition tried to label her. The Wilson marriage, the first Wilson marriage, that is to Ellen, when Woodrow Wilson was still a schoolmaster and the president of Princeton, he went to Bermuda for a vacation. And as somebody told me, there's something very dangerous about couples that take separate vacations. But indeed, Woodrow Wilson did, just because Mrs. Wilson felt she had to stay home in New Jersey with the three daughters, while Woodrow, now Woodrow, was suffering from these first minor strokes and really needed just to get away. So he went to Bermuda, and there he met a rather attractive divorcee who was something of a scalp hunter, I think. She was known let me put it this way. She smoked cigarettes back in the 1910s.
Oh, for God's sake. Right.
And so she was one of those women, if you know what I mean. And Wilson, who loved women, he loved playing to women, was very charmed by her, and she charmed by him. And they became great friends. They became great correspondents. There was a moment, as they saw each other over the years, in which the Wilson marriage had shut down a bit. Mrs. Wilson had lost a devoted brother, and she sank into a kind of depression. And during this period, Woodrow sought the comfort of Mrs. Peck. But I have every reason to believe, going through the letters, going through everything he said, everything she said, everything Mrs. Peck said, it really does seem to be nothing more than a platonic affair to me.
Nonetheless, Ellen was devastated by it. She grief-stricken, he guilt-stricken, but, you know, she did a Hillary Clinton. She stood by her man, eventually forgave him, and the couple moved on.
They did, and I think it was an emotional affair, and that was enough to, again, these two rather deeply religious people, Ellen and Woodrow Wilson, she being the daughter of a Presbyterian minister and the granddaughter of a Presbyterian minister. It was one of those occasions of sin in which I don't think they crossed the physical line, but they certainly crossed an emotional and, let us say, even spiritual line. And so for that, it was, as Ellen said, on her deathbed, as she told Woodrow's doctor and her physician as well, that this was really the only cause of consternation in their entire marriage. But even then, she believed there had not been a physical affair. And believe me, I wish there had been. It would have made for a slightly juicier book. But
look,
the book is
almost excessively juicy, I don't think. Now, let's belt into some politics now. One of the great anecdotes of how Wilson, the academic, outsmarted the party bosses of New Jersey. Tell us that.
Well, it's quite something. You know, in 1910, Woodrow Wilson was the president of a small college in New Jersey, Princeton University. Little more than 1,000 students. New Jersey was then, as some say is now, the most corrupt state in the Union. And it was run by a very powerful political machine of the Democratic Party. Realizing their reputation had become so terrible, this machine decided we need a puppet. So why don't we get the squeaky cleanest man in the state of New Jersey? Let's get that president of Princeton, you know, who has a nice social agenda, is reforming higher education in the United States. Let's get him and run him as the puppet. And they did. They did just that. And Wilson won in a landslide, even though he had never run for office in his life. And the very first thing he did in office was get rid of the political machine. I mean, he literally banned them from the public buildings. Well, now every eye in America is turning toward New Jersey and saying, who is this man? And a politician was born.
Let's sort of move on an increasing rate. The U.S. stumbles onto the world stage as a full-blown colossus, turning overnight from the world's largest debtor nation to practically its sole creditor. He arrives in Europe to negotiate peace. He's greeted with an ecstasy no American president had ever matched, hailed, as you said earlier, as the savior of mankind. But things didn't go too well, and he's wrestled back to earth by Clemenceau and Lloyd George.
And I might even add, your Billy Hughes gave him.
Yes, Australia's Billy Hughes, yeah.
I think we should throw that in. Wilson, sorry to say, to my Australian friends, found him a little nettlesome, although I dare say some Australians did as well. But, indeed, Wilson was thought to be somewhat naive when he went off to Paris, and a lot of people to this day say, oh, well, Clemenceau and Lloyd George really took Wilson for a ride, pulled the wool over his eyes, and so forth. I don't believe any of that, and I think when you read the book, you'll see as much. Wilson knew everything that was going on, but he walked into a kind of improbable situation, which was this. There were 24 nations seated at the table there, trying to settle the war and trying to figure out the future. 23 of those nations had very political agendas, and they were very singular. They were very selfish agendas. They were out for territory and treasure. They were out to reinstate themselves. The only country at that table that did not have such an agenda was the United States. That was Woodrow Wilson. He went over there with no eye on an empire. He didn't want to gather territory. He didn't want to get money out of this war. He had only one genuine ambition, and that was to create a League of Nations which might assure that the world had just fought what came to be known as the war to end all wars.
Yeah, that's true. That is true. But he had his famous 14 points, and we haven't got time to go through them. But most of them were fairly visionary. And here he is being hobbled, and his health starts to crack up. Tell us that he suffered repeated episodes in Paris that were probably strokes, perhaps even early onsets of dementia, and there were fits of paranoia and of incoherence.
All true. And it becomes a little frightening when you consider this is the man now in charge of drawing the map of the world. And I mean that quite literally. The map was so big, they had a big map that they put on the floor. And the big four, Orlando, Clemenceau, Lord George, and Woodrow Wilson, would literally get on their hands and knees and start drawing lines that became countries. I mean, Iraq, Syria, Yugoslavia, Czechoslovakia, these countries are all created there in 1919. And indeed, a lot of it, as I more than suggest in the book, was being controlled by this man who was suffering from certain mental lapses. There's one day, as you can read in the book, as you have, Philip, that I just find just mind-boggling, which is the day Woodrow Wilson walks into a room and says, "Oh, I don't like the way the furniture works here. The green is clashing with the purple, and we've got to move all the red chairs in one corner and all the blue chairs in another corner." And the doctor is sort of looking at him and saying, "Mr. President, perhaps we should take a walk." And then an hour later, Woodrow Wilson is sitting down with the other members of the Big Four, and they go back to redrawing the map. Not rearranging furniture, he was rearranging the world.
Well, he was trying to rearrange some pretty big furniture symbolically. Let me just rattle through some of the famous 14 points. No more secret agreements, open covenants openly arrived at, free navigation of all seas, an end to all economic barriers between countries, countries to reduce weapon numbers, and I particularly liked five, all the decisions regarding colonies should be impartial. This bloke was light years ahead of his time.
Centuries, and maybe too far ahead, you see, in some ways. The more I got into the book, the more I realized there is a pendulum in history, and pendulums can swing only so far before they swing back. And that was certainly the case when Woodrow Wilson was an educator trying to reform higher education in America, which then translated to the rest of the world, but especially true in dealing with the world situation now. And that was the case. All these visionary things could not be achieved, but a good number of them were, and I think the spirit of that idealism still exists.
Yeah, remarkable. I forgot to mention early on that he learned shorthand. And this was a very useful skill for him as a politician, as an academic, all through his life.
Quite amazing. Here he was as a teenager. I think even then, when he had his eye on a political career, he thought this would be a wonderful tool to have. And it was quite amazing for me to go through Woodrow Wilson's papers and find some of the most famous speeches ever delivered by an American. There, the first draft is in shorthand. And then he also became an expert typist, so he could also sit down at his little manual typewriter and then just type up what he had just written in shorthand, and then I could follow draft by draft as he would use pen and ink, rewriting what he had typed, and then he would retype it himself. And that was the procedure he brought all the way to the White House.
By absolute coincidence, I was spending a fair bit of time today rereading some of Lincoln's speeches and correspondence, and I think he was one of the most remarkable men in history, particularly coming from that very humble background with no formal education after the age of 15. Comparing how good a stylist, how good a writer do you think Wilson was?
I think he was a very good stylist. I would say he, being the most intellectual president the United States has ever had, the only PhD we've ever had, in his early years as an academician, I would say his style actually was a little stodgy, and he wrote by and large like an academician. And then it's as though a switch got tripped, because as soon as he really entered politics and became a politician, the style became something quite different. And I can almost hear the oratory of the pulpit. I can almost hear his father giving sermons, because the speeches become somewhat sermonic, not in the content necessarily, but in the patterns, in the delivery of them. They become almost wave-like as he speaks, and there's such a natural quality to it. He really was a fantastic orator, and he had a beautiful voice as well, so that was extremely helpful. And I think that was what made him so effective a politician.
Let's circle back to his racist attitudes, because in the dying days of his presidency, dying literally, America was convulsed by race riots, by lynchings, by strikes that were violently put down, and even Wall Street was bombed, which resulted in the death of almost 40 people. How did he respond to this?
Well, this was a time of great anarchy in the world, starting with the American entry into the war in 1917. Wilson clamped down hard, certainly when it came to alien and sedition laws, and it was, and this is an irony, for the most progressive president the United States had had, he then became the most repressive as well. And he really did clamp down when it came to censorship and so forth, and some people went to jail, including, famously, America's most important socialist, Eugene V. Debs. And Wilson had him sent to jail, or the law had him sent to jail, but Wilson, even years later, would not pardon him. So that occurred. And the race riots of 1919, I think, are very much related to World War I. I think a lot of black soldiers who served in the war came home and they thought, this will be our moment to be integrated into society, because we have proved ourselves as Americans. We are as red-blooded as any other American, despite the color of our skin. And in fact, the opposite happened, largely, I think, because mostly the white supremacists in the South realized that the blacks did expect something more, and they were trying to push them back into a box. And this was the first great moment in which African Americans rebelled across the country. And the summer of 1919 became a summer of vast race riots everywhere, the worst in American history.
And as you point out in the book, in a sense, he begins the surveillance state.
He really does. And I think, and I don't want to be glib about this, but it was something of an Al-Qaeda moment for the United States, in that for the first time there was this invisible anarchistic enemy without borders, you see. And you mentioned the bombs that were appearing and 40 people dying on Wall Street, and suddenly mail bombs were arriving in the homes of senators and important industrialists. And so for that reason, and because it was a period of rising communism and a lot of immigration into the United States that was unchecked, it was a period in which Wilson, running the government, said, we've just got to clamp down.
One of my favorite lines from T.S. Eliot can be reduced to an aphorism: between the ideal and the reality falls the shadow. And it was finally a pretty big shadow that fell between his ideals and the political reality.
There's no question about it, and in some ways, I've often felt I was writing a Greek tragedy here, because I think Wilson's greatest strength was his adherence to his principles, which involved a reluctance ever to compromise. That also became his fatal flaw, because when he came back to the United States with the treaty, which he had negotiated, but you have to remember, in American law, only the Senate can ratify the treaty. And so he came home to an opposition Congress that wanted nothing to do with anything Wilson brought back from Paris. And Wilson realized that he was coming up against this severe opposition. And it reached a point where even the severest critics said, you know, Mr. President, if you just give this one little bit, this small compromise, we'll give you your treaty. But Wilson would not yield. And so in the end, he did shoot himself in the foot and did himself in.
I am a broken piece of machinery, he said shortly before dying on February the 3rd, 1924. He was comparatively young, really. What, about 67, 68?
Exactly right. He had just turned 67.
Yeah. And describe his end. How did he die?
Well, he hobbled out of the White House, quite literally the lamest duck in American history. Again, nobody had really even seen him for the last year and a half in office. He was able to ride in the parade for his successor, Warren G. Harding's inauguration, but he couldn't climb the steps to witness it. You know, one of the great photo opportunities in American history every 4 years is seeing that transition of power. Instead, he retired to a house in Washington, D.C., the only president to remain in the Capitol after serving in the White House. And there he really just physically and somewhat mentally gradually faded away.
But he's come bouncing back thanks to you, Scott. Thanks for that. A. Scott Berg's book is called very simply Wilson, published by Simon & Schuster. Scott, thanks for that. Talk again soon. That's your lot. Don't forget to visit our website to leave your comments. Just put Late Night Live into your search engine. Oh, on our next, we're going back to the roots of the Liberal Party and its first and forgotten leader, Joseph Cook. And that'll help us explore the party's trajectory. And following in the footsteps of Max Dupain, we talk to his son, Rex. Stick around now for the news on RN, and we will see you later.